Hello and welcome to Well, Don't Just Stand There. I'm Johan, and this week we'll be talking a little bit about CISA, the Cybersecurity Information Sharing Act of 2015, a little bit about Windows 10 and Windows Phone, what the hell's happening with Nokia Here Maps, and Twitter. What are they going to do about their user problem? Coming up, it's Monday, August 3rd, Episode 1. It's time for a segment I'm calling This Week in Privacy. You guys may remember CISPA, the Senate bill that basically curtailed a lot of sort of undefined protections of privacy that we have on the web. And it's back as CISA, or the Cybersecurity Information Sharing Act of 2015. It's in the Senate right now, sponsored by Senators Dianne Feinstein and Richard Burr, a combo of Democrats and Republicans. And it's coming through the Senate Intelligence Committee. The gist of this thing is basically the act is intended to make it easier for private companies to share information with the government about cybersecurity threats. So making it easier for a company like Google or Facebook or Twitter to share information with the government on their users or their potential threats for cybersecurity. Now, obviously, you can see where that could get concerning. A lot of the major opposition to this bill right now pertains to whether or not there are adequate privacy protections for what happens to your information once the government has it. And right now, the bill doesn't have that information in place. We don't know how they're going to protect your information once the government has it. What is in place is immunity and legal protection for the companies that are providing your information to the government. So you can sort of see the lopsided representation in this bill for the current concerns of the parties involved. Business is accounted for, but not the average Joe Schmo whose information might be getting forwarded to the Department of Homeland Security, who, in their good graces, is going to be trusted with sanitizing this information and making sure that it's appropriately private. Now, another concern for the bill is the fact that once the Department of Homeland Security, who is supposed to be the main receiver of this information, gets that information, they can basically forward it along to any other intelligence agency. And that sort of interagency sharing doesn't leave a lot of protections for the people whose information is being shared. And that's one of the major contentions of people who are opposing the bill in the Senate right now, like Senator Ron Wyden and Senator Patrick Leahy, who are attempting to make changes to this bill. Other concerns about the contents and aims of the bill include the fact that not only are cybercrimes covered under what information can be shared by these technology companies, but also anything that can be considered a violent crime. Now, I don't know about you guys, but I feel like that's a pretty wide umbrella of crimes, and it's pretty poorly defined. Some of the amendments that they are attempting to pass on this bill would remove that provision entirely to make sure that only cybercrime-related information is being forwarded onto the government. Now, why am I so concerned about this? Well, it simply turns around the former formal relationship that most of the companies that you deal with on the internet have had. Previously, if the government suspected you of being involved in any kind of crime, cybercrime or otherwise, a judge needed to issue a warrant. A warrant needed to be issued to the company that has your information, and then that company would relinquish that information. And only the information covered in the bounds of the warrant that was issued. With this bill, the companies that you are giving up your private information to can, without your knowledge, give up all kinds of personal information about you, about your activities, just if there is a hint that you might be involved in some kind of cybercrime-related activity. And cybercrime itself is such a broadly defined word that I think I could pretty easily tag most of the people listening right now with some kind of suspicious behavior. Were you Googling the word torrent? Were you visiting a site where somebody posted information about cybercrimes? Did you read an article that talked about a vulnerability or a hack that had to do with government information or some kind of a leak? Were you reading about Edward Snowden? These things are all cybercrime related. So what's to stop the people that have your information from sharing it with the government and having immunity for sharing it and not having to notify you that your information has been shared? So if that's happening, there damn well better be a warrant, and you ought to be able to find out who exactly is giving up your information, to whom, when, and why. If you want to find out more information, there is a website up that's CISPAisBack.org or CISPAisBack.org, and has more information about what the potential implications of this bill are and ways that you can act right now. Another good resource if you want to find out more is going to the Electronic Freedom Foundation's website, EFF.org. They detail some of the steps that they're taking to inform people about the potential implications of this bill. And there's a pretty funny initiative where they're trying to get everybody to fax their lawmakers, since this law seems straight out of many decades ago in terms of how it's treating the implications of this kind of technology policy. So check out those resources and get mad. Now, it's not all intelligence and privacy doom and gloom. Windows 10 is out.
Edwards, let's put it on.
Put what on?
The last
Windows 10
you'll ever wear.
How is it? I don't know. I haven't used it, but by all accounts, this is a return to form for Microsoft, coming back out of the Windows 8 slump. Built for touch, but nobody wanted to touch it. But I actually wanted to talk about Windows Phone. So recently, Microsoft took a huge $7.6 billion write-down on their Nokia acquisition. They're buying a mobile phone company. They're one major Windows Phone manufacturer who took a huge bet on going for Windows Phone instead of Android or whatever the other option might have been, continuing to work on their own homegrown OS. But they wound up writing down the entire acquisition cost of Nokia. So the question is, what is the future path for Windows on phones? And Windows 10 for phones is coming out soon, but this might be the last hurrah for the platform if they're not able to answer some of the questions about what is the actual value proposition of a Windows phone these days. It's no longer having the number one Microsoft apps, because Microsoft apps are launching on iOS and Android now, especially to capture market share where the market already is. So you're not getting the leading Microsoft experience on Windows phone anymore. Hardware is certainly a question. Nokia was known for making pretty innovative-looking handsets. One of their Lumia phones had one of the highest pixel density cameras on the market, and that was a pretty big draw for that particular handset. But nothing really major coming out of the Microsoft camp lately. The recent consolidation in the Windows Phone department at Microsoft has drawn comments from them saying that they're going to focus on a smaller number of models and more flagships, of which there have been pretty much zero worthy of note in the past year or so. It'll be interesting to see whether or not Microsoft turns up the heat on new models for Windows Phone, or whether or not they simply let this all hang by the wayside. Also, apparently, Microsoft has $100 billion sitting overseas. Now, not coming into U.S. bank accounts, for the same reason that probably a lot of other large tech companies like Apple are keeping huge hoards of cash overseas, because they don't want to repatriate that money and immediately pay massive corporate taxes on that money once it moves on shore. This has actually been a pretty big problem for the U.S. government in terms of slowing down domestic investment or domestic use of money that U.S.-based companies have earned. But it's overseas, and so that's where the money stays. For $100 million, Microsoft could probably buy every single Android handset on the market, install Windows Phone on it, and then put it back up for sale. But for now, that money sits in some accounts overseas. Nokia, which is still a company, even without its phone division, it has software products, and most notably, it retains the rights to HearMaps. And HearMaps was a product that came onto Windows phones, but it was distinct from Bing Maps, and it remained a separate product and only showed up on Nokia Windows phones. Now, Nokia has been shopping that around, and there have been several suitors, one of which was Uber. And Uber is definitely looking for a competitive advantage in its mapping software. But Nokia has recently turned them down and is selling HearMaps to a combination of BMW, Audi, and Mercedes. So one can only assume that BMW gets it on the weekends, Audi gets it on Monday, Wednesday, Friday, and Mercedes gets it on Tuesdays and Thursdays, however they work that out. But the amount of mapping software out available right now is pretty huge, and a lot of companies are starting to view having their own mapping software as a real competitive advantage. You don't want to have to rely on Google Maps if you're Apple, and so Apple Maps exists. If you're a phone company like Nokia or a former phone company, you want your own mapping solution. They want their maps in other people's hardware, and so you have HearMaps. Microsoft not wanting to be left out, Bing Maps, and then you have all of the original mapping companies from before the digital gold rush, places like TomTom and other in-car GPS units, all have their own. Now, what's another thing that comprehensive, high-quality mapping software might help out with? A little thing called autonomous cars, which it's suspected Apple may be working on. We know Google's working on it. And Uber has shopped out some of the best autonomous driving labs in this country's universities, specifically for the purpose of exploring autonomous cars. And I'm sure Uber would be very excited to get rid of the biggest cost center in their entire business, which is the driver. But let's turn to the problem child of social media, Twitter. Stock, when it came out on its IPO, shot up to almost $70 a share, and now it's tumbling down towards $30 a share, which is pretty close to the original price it was offered at. The question on everybody's mind is, why can't Twitter get more people active on its service? It created 8 million new monthly active users by the most recent quarterly financial results that they released. Now, for a lot of companies, 8 million monthly active users would be an absolutely phenomenal increase. But when you're comparing your batting average to behemoths like Facebook, where over 1 billion monthly active users on mobile are the bar that you're looking at, 8 million new users is not that impressive. That brings Twitter's monthly active users up to around 315 million, which by any count is a pretty impressive number, but their growth quarter over quarter, month over month, has remained pretty anemic. Some people say it's because the feed is not as easy to understand as Facebook's feed. It's harder to get feedback on the things that you post. People are not engaging as visibly with posts on Twitter as they might on Facebook. Likes are probably given more freely on a place like Facebook. Hearts are given more freely on a platform like Tumblr. Feedback is crucial. You're not going to want to post into the void unless you're sure that somebody's listening. But it conflicts with the core value proposition of what Twitter brings, which is the world at your fingertips as it happens. And if you're tossing your post into everyone's timeline it's going to be ephemeral. It's going to exist just temporarily. And the chance of you reaching the people that you might want to reach is a lot lower because Twitter doesn't tamper with an algorithm. It doesn't try to prioritize like Facebook does. It doesn't bring up the most relevant post in the past 24 hours, except recent changes at Twitter are now bringing that into your feed in a more limited fashion. But Twitter is sort of the pulse of the internet, and people think that's holding back growth. So the question has to be, at Twitter headquarters, do you sacrifice the virality, the pulse, the quick breakneck speed of updates that you're getting from that platform in order to make people feel like they're being engaged with more? And does that cut out the knees of the value proposition of the platform, which is everything is equally weighted? You're no less likely to be seen than a person with 40 million followers. The only difference is how many people are following you. But your tweet will be just as ephemeral. It will show up, and then another one will show up above it, and then another, and then another, and you'll disappear from view after a couple of minutes. So Twitter has been experimenting with the most interacted with tweets that are being surfaced. A here's what you missed that shows up and shows you some of the most engaged with posts, which is ironic because that, in a sense, creates a sort of feedback loop. The only way to get your post even more engaged with is to have a high engagement post to begin with. So does that predispose people who already are popular to get even more engagement? And they'll continue to interact, whereas people with 20 followers, 30 followers, 100 followers, their posts will sort of disappear into the ether unless they somehow happen to tap into whatever zeitgeist is happening at the time. There's been discussions of the star, the favoriting star, being changed into a heart. Supposedly Airbnb changed their star into a heart and increased engagement something like 30%. Because people felt like they were engaging with the post in a more friendly way, whereas a star can be a marker, you know, it's associated with favorites in your browser. But a heart is, you like this thing. And Facebook has the positive connotation of the thumbs up. So Twitter's definitely trying things out. But maybe the problem isn't how people feel about engaging. Maybe it's not seeing things that they want to engage with. Maybe changing the formula of the feed is the way to go forward. Maybe they create two feeds, one that's curated, one that isn't. Of course, the broader question is, does Twitter have to be a company that has a billion users? Certainly, the financials would pencil out in a nicer way. I'm sure the investors would be thrilled if they knew that Twitter was on a trajectory to be a 1 billion monthly active user company. But maybe it's just niche enough. Maybe 300 million users is a good amount, a survivable amount, and increasing that number every single quarter, as opposed to decreasing, is what the company should be aiming for. Maybe dumbing down the platform will hurt the value proposition. Maybe they can monetize the users they already have, but growth is king. And so you can bet there's going to be more shuffles at Twitter until they crack that egg. I wanted to thank you for tuning in to the first episode of, well, Don't Just Stand There. It's a little something I'm trying. I'll be experimenting with format and covering different things in the realm of tech and culture and startups and privacy. And if you have any recommendations or things that you want me to talk about, hit me up on Twitter. I'm at Johan Benedict with a K. And I'll hopefully see you guys next week. Thanks a lot. Music provided under Creative Commons license by Kevin MacLeod at Incompetech.